Well, tonight we're going to undertake a look at Europe. Europa Rising is the name of our little product. And, you know, most of us, especially in America, are not as conscious of current events as people in other countries. I remember when I was chairman of a semiconductor company, I had a major office in London, and I was never more surprised when I went to London to discover how they there in Europe paid attention to our local elections. In those days, I operated out of California, and I was a CEO of a public company, and I thought I was reasonably well informed about what was going on, but I constantly was amazed that our London staff, our European people, were tracking our elections even more closely than we do here. And it's interesting how, especially in Europe, the rank and file people on the street are aware of what's going on in the world. In America, you ask the average guy, and they may know the ball scores from the weekend, but you know a lot of this is oblivious to the average person. So I want to congratulate every one of you here tonight by your being here, showing an awareness and a concern, because there are some strategic changes going on our horizon. And the emergence of an enlarged European Union is going to impact our nation and our communities and every one of us as individuals. And the other reason we're addressing this, it also may have some biblical implications that will surprise you. So it's in that spirit we're going to take a look at where is Europe in prophecy? Is Europe in Bible prophecy? And will the Antichrist come out of Europe? Many people think so, but why do they think so, and is that biblical? And will the EU eclipse the United Nations? Many people feel it may. And how will the European Union affect the cauldron we call the Middle East? And how will the European Union affect the United States? These are questions that should be concerning every one of us, and we're going to take a look at some of those in this review. And the first thing I'd like to do is explore the background. Before we get into the dynamic things that are going on the horizon, let's take a look and see what the Bible says about these things. And why do so many Bible scholars attribute such significance to what's going on in Europe today? And it all goes back to the book of Daniel in part. You know, the Bible in general speaks of history, both past and future history, through the lens of Israel. Almost all the way through the Bible, whatever you're seeing there, it's in reference to how it impacts the state of God's chosen people, the people of Israel. But there are some exceptions, and perhaps the most dramatic exceptions are Daniel chapter 2 through 7. That whole section of Daniel is not written in Hebrew. It's written in the Gentile language of that period, Aramaic. And now Daniel was taken captive as a teenager, and raised at court, graduate school, sort of, to serve at court. And Nabopolassar, the king, had an outstanding young son, a general, Nebuchadnezzar, who was an excellent military man. He conquered their major adversaries. But on one of those expeditions, he finds that his dad has died, and he returns home to take over the kingdom. He's now not just general of the army, he's king of Babylon, young king. And he inherits the staff people of his father, these old cronies that advised his dad. One night, Nebuchadnezzar has a very troubling dream, and he uses it as an opportunity to see if his people, his staff people, can, if they really can perform, or if they're just going to bluff their way through these things. So he asks them to interpret the dream, but he won't tell them what the dream is. It's up to them to know what the dream is and to interpret it. Of course, they can't do that. And so they stall for a little time. He gets impatient. He says, off with your heads. He knew how to reduce headcount to make a budget. Well, it turns out Daniel was in that job category. So he would have been part of that execution order. So he goes to his supervisor and says, hey, give us a crack at this. And so they do. And Daniel's three friends have a prayer meeting that night. God reveals it to Daniel. The next day, Daniel goes before the king and the court and all these advisors, and it's one of the great grandstanding chapters in the Bible, Daniel chapter 2. It's very readable. The dream is described there, and it is interpreted for you there. But it's a background that we want to have some insight into. The dream that Nebuchadnezzar apparently had, in his dream he saw a very large metal image, and the head was of gold, and the belly and chest of silver, the belly and thighs of brass, and the legs were iron. In fact, the feet were iron, but the iron was mixed with clay. And many people say, gee, that's five elements. It's actually four with the last in two phases. As this dream proceeds, a stone cut without hands smites the image at its feet and crumbles and blows away. And a mountain grows up to fill the whole earth. And not just that region. The language implies the whole earth. Now, that is a pretty weird dream. I suspect if you had that dream, you'd be kind of curious too. Nebuchadnezzar somehow knew it was significant, and he wanted it interpreted. So Daniel, first of all, tells him the dream, and that, of course, impresses him, because he obviously had to learn that by supernatural means. But Daniel goes on to explain it. He says, what it turns out to be is a timeline. And the head of gold represents Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian Empire. But he says, you're that head of gold. But you're going to be succeeded by another. And certainly they were. The Persians conquered the Babylonians, and then the Greeks conquered the Persians, and then Rome conquered the Greeks. And most people who study the details of this recognize that this last empire is one empire in two phases. We get that amplified for us in Daniel chapter 7 and some other places. But what we have here portrayed is a very interesting insight in the Bible, that between that time, the time of Daniel, and the time that God himself sets up his own kingdom on the planet Earth, there are going to be four empires. Not three, not seven, or whatever, four. And it's interesting that God has chosen to reveal to us all of Gentile dominion. In fact, the biblical term for this period is called the times of the Gentiles, because from Babylon on, the Gentiles have had dominion over God's people in one way or another. Now, Babylon rose about 606 B.C., and it was 539 that it was conquered by Cyrus the Persian. And the Persians ruled for about two centuries until this young guy, Alexander the Great, conquers the Persians. And even as a young man, he conquers all the way to India, by the way. Incredible career. But when he dies, his four generals divide it up. The real question is, about 68 B.C., that which was the Greek Empire is conquered by Rome. It's on the rise. About 68 B.C., by most reckonings. The question is, who conquered the Romans? And the profound answer to that is no one. There wasn't some succeeding empire that conquered. It broke into pieces. Just exactly what the implications are in the vision. But most scholars recognize that those pieces are destined to come back together in a final form of what scholars still call the Roman Empire. In fact, you'll find this strange phrase in the Bible commentary, the revived Roman Empire. And that's a quaint idea. It could be easily laughed at for many, many years, except as we stand back, we notice some interesting things are happening on the horizon. Now, by the way, that was Daniel 2 that we reviewed. I take for granted that most of you are familiar with it. We're just reviewing it. If you haven't really studied it, I encourage you just to sit down and read Daniel 2. It explains itself. Late in his life, Daniel himself gets a series of visions in Daniel chapter 7. The idioms God uses are very different than the ones he used with Nebuchadnezzar, but it's the same subject matter. Daniel is treated to a series of creatures that are sort of like animals. In Daniel 7, the first thing he sees is something comes up out of the sea, like a winged lion. It's followed by a bear that rises up on one side. And it's followed by a leopard that moves so fast he hardly touches the ground. And then there's the last one, the fourth one. Daniel can't find an animal to liken it to, even descriptively. He just calls it the great and terrible beast. And it grows into a phase where it has 10 heads. In Daniel 2, we had 10 toes. And in Daniel 7, we got 10 heads. These idioms are all picked up in the book of Revelation and tied together for you. And I'm being very superficial here, but if you study the details of these passages, and also Daniel 8 and 9, all the way through to 11, it amplifies these things, and it's pretty clear that the information that's conveyed in Daniel 7 is the same information as Daniel 2, but from God's point of view. In Daniel 2, we had man's perception, bright, shiny metals. But God sees them as a series of voracious beasts. But that summarizes what the Bible calls times of the Gentiles. And a basic study in Daniel is essential, of course, to really understand other books of prophecy, including the book of Revelation. Well, most of us, as we stand back, realize that civilization had its beginnings in that region on the planet Earth we call the Fertile Crescent, usually including Egypt, Assyria, and Babylonia as the earliest empires. And in these empires, there is a city on the banks of the Euphrates called Babylon. It was the capital of the first world dictator. And interestingly enough, the Bible seems to indicate that it has a destiny yet future. It's interesting, as we watch the whole Iraq war, the most important city in Iraq was never mentioned on the news. Babylon, because it's not a military target. It's not relevant in today, and yet it's reemerging, and that has profound implications for all of us. But in any case, after the Assyrian Empire, the Babylonians take over, and the Babylonians then get conquered by the Persians. The Persians include a much larger territory than the Babylonians did, but superseded it. In Daniel chapter 11, first couple of verses summarizes the Persian Empire, and one of the key people that you want to be sensitive to is the sixth guy, Artaxerxes Longimanus. He's the one that follows the leader of that was the king that was in the days of Esther. But in any case, the Greek Empire goes from about 332 until the Romans conquered in 68 BC, and the Persians get conquered by the Greeks. Alexander the Great, as I say, conquered all the way to the to India in about 334 to 323. He only lived a few years, but he died as a young man. And his four of his key generals, divide the empire. And Macedonia and Greece fell under Cassander, Asia Minor and Thrace under Lysimachus. The two key guys are Syria and Babylon that was taken over by Seleucus, and Egypt, Arabia, and Syria taken over by Ptolemy. It's interesting that people talk, by the way, Cassandra and Lysimachus took the western part. Seleucus and Ptolemy are the two strong guys, and the struggles between these two dynasties, of course, have Israel right in between as a buffer state. Now, many people talk about the four centuries that between the Old Testament and New Testament. We have the Old Testament goes up to the book of Malachi. And of course, the New Testament starts about 400 years later. And some scholars call those 400 years the silent years, not realizing those years are covered in the Bible. But they're covered in advance in Daniel chapter 11. And it's very interesting. If you study Daniel 11 carefully, you'll discover that from verse 5 to 35, you have the six Ptolemies and the eight Seleucids are detailed there. And it's in the reign of Ptolemy Philadelphus that the Old Testament is translated into Greek. Now, what's interesting about that means the book of Daniel, the whole Old Testament was translated into Greek 3 centuries before Christ was born. So when the Bible talks about his genealogy, the city he's going to be born in, all the 300 details of Christ's life, they're written down in the Old Testament 3 centuries before Christ makes his appearance. That in itself, you say you can't prove the Bible. Yes, you can if you do your homework. And so I encourage you to explore that. It's very important. Now, it's this last guy of this list under the Seleucid Empire, a guy by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes, that is famous because he really had it in for the Jews. He desecrates the temple. He makes the Torah reading a capital crime. He slaughters a sow on the brazen altar in Jerusalem. But he doesn't stop there. He erects an altar, an idol to Zeus in the Holy of Holies. And that does it. That triggers the Maccabean revolt, and in the 3 years of fighting after they threw off the yoke of the Greek Empire, they rededicate the temple, and that rededication is celebrated to this day by the Jews in their festival of Hanukkah. And don't get confused by some of the colorful legends that surround any of our holidays. The real significance of Hanukkah is the rededication of that temple after Antiochus Epiphanes had desecrated it. It happened to be on his birthday. But in any case, the remainder of this chapter, from verse 35 to 45, the Holy Spirit uses this occasion of speaking of Antiochus Epiphanes to go beyond him to this last world dictator that has 33 different labels in the Old Testament and 13 in the New. We tend to call him, unfortunately, the Antichrist, which is, of course, Antichrist or in place of Christ, and it's descriptive, but it's also myopic. There's many other aspects to this, but we'll use that term because it's commonly used, for this final world leader, the most attractive leader the world has ever seen, will emerge, and he has a destiny of deceit that is a great part of the big biblical end times. Okay, that's what the Bible says. Let's take a look at the Roman Empire in a little more detail. It was about 146 that Rome conquers Greece. And in 133, the Lysimachus kingdoms fall. That's what you'd consider the western part of Turkey. In 64 B.C., Seleucus' kingdom falls. In 31 B.C., that's the Battle of Actium. That's where Egypt falls. In 44 B.C., we have the... I've got these in the wrong order. Julius Caesar should be before 31 B.C., so I made a mistake on the slide. I apologize. But it's 64 A.D. that Nero begins his persecutions. When you get to 284 A.D., Diocletian, who's the emperor then, by then it has grown so large he can't administer it all. So he divides it into two parts, two subunits, the western leg and the eastern leg. Again, suggestive of those two legs in Daniel's vision, incidentally. It's in 312 A.D., I want you to focus on the fact that the emperor, Constantine, moves the capital of the world from Rome to Byzantium and renames it Constantinople, the new Rome. Many Bible scholars fail to appreciate the fact that the Roman Empire was not just Europe. It was the East also. And that raises some interesting insights, and it raises some interesting enigmas that we'll talk about. And, of course, it's about 476 A.D. that the western leg of the Roman Empire, that starts to fragment, goes into pieces. The eastern leg survives the western leg by 1,000 years, till the Muslims under Islam, the Muslims finally overrun it. But it's so distinctive, we give it a different name. We call it the Byzantine Empire, but it's actually the eastern leg of the Roman Empire. It's interesting that each segment of the fragments that the Roman Empire breaks up into has its day in the sun, has an era of dominance. The Dutch, the Germans, the French, the British, Spanish, they each have a shot at a major colonization, but none of them attain an empire in the true sense of the term. But the scripture would have us believe that they're going to reassemble into some kind of vestige of the original Roman Empire. Well, let's take a look at the Roman Empire. It was very, very extensive. Most of us are familiar with it because all of us, in one way or another, are products of the culture and the background that was laid down there from in the first five centuries of this era. Now, the Roman Empire breaks into pieces. We have, let's just pick it up, in the early years. We obviously had Rome, the Roman emphasis from, even though the political capital was moved to Byzantium, the religious capital really emerges in Rome. And as the political power starts to wane, the religious power tries to step into that vacuum. You won't understand the history of Europe unless you understand the struggle of the Vatican to try to gain temporal power over over that region. And, of course, Byzantium is the capital of the world. And, of course, we have Islam rising in the 6th century, 7th century, out of the Arabian area. So we have Europe is going to struggle in the wake of the collapse of these powers because we have the Roman authority in the West, we have the rise of Islam from Arabia, and the Byzantine Empire trying to stabilize between these two major functions. And so the restructuring of the Mediterranean world shaped the whole character of medieval Europe. And as Rome receded, the new cultural forces swept across Europe. The migration of a number of Germanic peoples, the so-called barbarians, filtered into the Western European territories of the Roman Empire for several centuries. And many of them were incorporated into the Roman army, Roman military. Many interacted with the remains of the Roman culture and with the Celts. And the Celts were isolated in the British Isles during the retreat of the Roman rule and the influx of Germanic people up until about the 6th century. About 500, when Rome could no longer effectively control the West, Europe was divided into different homelands for different ethnic groups that are emerging here. You have the Ostrogoths that settled in Italy, the Visigoths that found a home in Iberia, which is what we would call today Spain and Portugal, and the Franks, of course, flourished in Gaul, which is present-day France. Fascinating me to realize that the French are really descendants of the Germans. I don't think they look at it that way, but anyway. But the Angles and the Saxons, of course, occupied parts of the British Isles. And so the groups that settled in the heavily Romanized areas of Europe near the Mediterranean accepted the elements of Roman governance And they adopted Christianity in one of its many different forms. But you won't understand the history of Europe unless you really understand the struggles of power that were centered around the Vatican. And if you're interested in this area, we won't get into it here, of course, we've got too much to cover. I encourage you to take a look at Dave Hunt's book, The Woman Rides the Beast. It's one of the best documented treatments of this. Dave and I did a briefing pack on it together called The Kingdom of Blood. That's also a fast way to get the highlights of it if you want to go take that further. By the 9th century, the fragile balance of Roman Christian and Germanic traditions was disrupted by the violent influx of all kinds of new people. And these people were integrated into the European society with settlement, conversions, negotiation that accompanies that kind of immigration. And so the various regions then start to develop their own identities. They have the glue, if you will, of the Roman culture, the Roman roads, the infrastructure. And by the way, the other thing Rome did is establish a uniform monetary system. Many of us overlook what an impact that had, because it is, again, these tendencies were an offset to the mixed tribes that were moving in. And so on the one hand, they had local identities. On the other hand, they still had a common cultural background. And so the older kingdoms in the British Isles, France, Germany, they recover their equilibrium after these assaults. And that testifies to the strength of the earlier synthesis of Roman Christian and Germanic traditions that put Europe together in the first place. So now the newcomers that are coming in from three primary directions, and they cause panic throughout Europe. We have, of course, the Muslims that come up from the Arabian area, across North Africa, and also up through the Dardanelles and so forth. And they establish all kinds of bases in the Mediterranean. They were stopped by Charles Martel's forces, the famous Battle of Tours, in 731. If he hadn't been such an effective military man, I suspect that all of us would be speaking Arabic. But in any case, these various incursions were halted by his standoff there. Then we have the Scandinavian Vikings, came from the north. They were seafaring groups of landless Danish, Swedish, Norwegian warriors that sought fame and fortune through plundering and trading, and also demanding tribute of various forms from the fearful residents of the British Isles and also the coastal regions of the continent. And so they establish, they colonize Iceland, interestingly enough, and, of course, the British Isles and the east coast of Ireland. And also they set up settlements in what became called, naturally, Normandy in France. And they also go all the way through to the Kiev in Russia. They have a profound impact in the history of Russia. So now another group are the Magyars, as they're called by some encyclopedias. I suspect that they're descendants of Magog, the Scythians, if you will. They came from the Asiatic steppes in the east, and that's a region that includes Kazakhstan or Central Asia. In fact, the Scythians controlled the southern steppes of Russia from the Ukraine all the way to China until from the 10th century B.C. to about the 3rd century B.C. The Great Wall of China was built to keep them out. But anyway, they're moving west, and they settled Hungary and converted Christianity, many of them. And Europe eventually fragments in response to these waves of attacks. Each region develops new alliances and new identities. And, of course, in 1450, the Muslims overrun Byzantium, ending the eastern leg of the original Roman Empire. That's just a quick superficial summary. Well, as we move into, we can't obviously recount all history, just hit a few highlights that are relevant to our purpose today. The Holy Roman Empire had its origins in the empire established by the Frankish king Charlemagne in 800 AD. He was crowned by Pope Leo III. That starts the whole idea of the emperor being crowned by the pope. He crowned him as the emperor of the Romans. That was the first use of that title since the fall of the Western Roman Empire in 476 AD. Now, his empire, his kingdom, disintegrated within 40 or 43 years. But the concept of the Holy Roman Empire endures for another 1,000 years. And we'll take a quick look at that. Early, by the time you get to the 13th century, the Holy Roman Empire was engulfed in a civil war between the rival German princes and who were vying for the title of emperor. Emperor Frederick II, known as the Wonder of the World, restored power and prestige to the empire, bringing it to one of its highest points since the death of Charlemagne in 814. However, in order to win the support of the German princes, he greatly increased their independence throughout the empire. And as a result, when he dies in 1250, the title of Holy Roman Empire was claimed by many of these guys, and the civil war began within the empire. So you'll discover that this whole idea of the Holy Roman Empire is more of a concept than really a tightly run empire in the traditional sense. And it was Emperor Charles V who came to control more territory than any other Holy Roman Emperor before them. He was already ruler of extensive areas in Europe, America, parts of Africa in about 1530 when he became the Holy Roman Emperor. But he was the last to be crowned by the Pope. And he struggled to maintain his empire from outside threats and so forth, but they gradually dwindled. And after his death, of course, it continued to decline in both area and importance until it was finally dissolved by Emperor Francis II in 1806. So you see, you're bringing this. We're now up about the time of the Louisiana Purchase, just to give you a rough feeling here. And following the defeats of the Napoleonic Wars, he just abandoned he dissolved the Holy Roman Empire. And he proclaimed himself the Emperor of Austria and allied Austria with Britain and Russia to fight Napoleon. But in truth, the empire really lasted throughout those centuries more as an idea than a political or administrative reality. Voltaire summarized it so eloquently. He says, it was neither holy, nor Roman, nor an empire. But you'll hear that term all the time. It was a legacy, though, that was obsessed with Italy as a centroid. It was a continuous resistance of the German nobles to any strong central authority. Made the empire essentially ungovernable for over 500 years. And you need to realize that the king was really picked by the nobles. The nobles didn't want a strong king. So you can see how that would be a self-fulfilling prophecy. So it's interesting that despite its rather ignominious decline and end, the Holy Roman Empire as a concept continued to exercise great influence on the imaginations of the later German imperialists. Otto von Bismarck, the Prussian king, William I, established the German Empire in 1871. They explicitly encouraged the label or the title, the Second Empire, as if that was the first, you see, as to borrow some of the glory and power enjoyed by the Holy Roman Empire at its peak. And Hitler, Adolf Hitler, and his National Socialist supporters, the Nazis, they similarly appropriated the legacy of the First Empire by dubbing their own regime the Third Reich, the Third Empire. So you see that, again, it's just a concept. It lingers. And, of course, both regimes proved considerably briefer than the original empire during its peak, but they were equally ambitious. So the great powers of 16th century Europe were England, France, and Spain and Austria and the Ottoman Empire, and the Ottoman Empire obviously being here to the south. And the network of relations between the powerful states first emerged in Europe during the 16th century and then solidified in what is known as the 30 Years' War from about 1618 through 1648. And the 30 Years' War began as a Protestant revolt against King Ferdinand II's Catholic-controlled government, Bohemia, which later became the Czech Republic. And a series of religious and dynastic conflicts followed involving the great powers of Europe. It gets very complicated. I won't try to map it all as we go here. But the majority of the war is fought on German soil, with hostilities ending in a treaty, the Peace of Westphalia, and dashing the hopes for the German unification and significantly curtailing the power of the Holy Roman Empire and the Habsburgs. Habsburg family ruled Austria and Spain. And the Habsburg power peaked in the late 16th century when Spain conquered Portugal. But the 30 Years' War resulted in a great defeat of the Habsburgs by a coalition of the nations, including France and Sweden and the German principalities. And the accord also creates the Dutch nation as a nation. Now, France is going to emerge then as the dominant European power. The Netherlands will decline in power in the 18th century when its commercial and maritime rivalry with Britain led to a series of debilitating wars. In the 20th century, Britain and France declined as great powers as they attempted to hold on to their far-flung empires. Most of us are probably more familiar with that as it gets closer to our own period. The Habsburgs, it's interesting that the grandson of the Habsburgs is presently a parliament member with the European Parliament. I had lunch with Otto von Habsburg, and it was one of the more interesting discussions I've ever gotten into. We'll talk about that as we get a little further through here. Well, you can't talk about this kind of history, even a superficial skim over, without mentioning Napoleon. and who some people would argue is obviously the most famous Frenchman, except he wasn't French. He was Corsican, but I won't get into that here. He was born in 1769 and died in 1821, to give you a rough feeling here. But a young Napoleon Bonaparte was sent from a small island of Corsica to a military school in France. He graduated in 1875 and joined the French artillery and began a military career that would change history throughout Europe. And he conquered much of the Western Europe and became one of the greatest military leaders of all time. In 1793, he played an instrumental role in the French defeat of the British at Toulon, and he was promoted to the rank of brigadier general. And then he overthrew the French government and crowned himself, a very famous thing where he goes to get crowned, and he takes the crown from the Pope and crowns himself. So the man had many, many talents, but humility was not one of them. And so, but to talk a little bit about this, the Battle of the Nile. In 1798, the French fleet was defeated by a small British armada commanded by a guy by the name of Horatio Nelson at the Battle of the Nile. And this defeat left Napoleon stranded. But it also, the destruction of the French fleet guaranteed the naval supremacy of the British throughout the Mediterranean. Very major. It's funny how certain events like this become very pivotal in the whole course of history. And then the Battle of Trafalgar is a naval battle fought on October 21st of 1805. By a British fleet commanded, of course, by your friend and mine, Horatio Nelson. It was a combined French and Spanish fleet. It took place, obviously, off Cape Trafalgar in the southern coast of Spain. A pitting a fleet of 27 British ships under the command of Nelson and against the French and Spain combined. The battle began shortly before noon. It ended in the afternoon. Some 20 French and Spanish ships had been destroyed or captured, and not a single British vessel was lost. And the French admiral was taken prisoner, along with thousands of his sailors. The British did suffer about 1,500 casualties, not the least of which was Lord Nelson himself. And so, but the overwhelming British victory at the Battle of Trafalgar destroyed Napoleon's plan to invade England and help secure the supremacy of the British naval forces for the rest of the 1800s. And so it's probably one of the most celebrated naval engagements in history. It had profound implications in terms of its impact on everyone. So anyway, get back to Napoleon. He had a victory over the Austrian and Russian armies at Austerlitz, very well known. Then he invades Spain and starts the six-year Peninsular War, putting his brother Joseph on the throne as king. But in 1812, he makes a huge mistake. His army was the largest yet seen in Europe. But after going into Russia, you see, the Russians, interesting, neither Napoleon nor Hitler did their homework. They didn't know history. And as Hegel points out, the history teaches us that man learns nothing from history. Or Santayana puts it, he that doesn't know history will be doomed to repeat it. The Scythians, the ancestor of the Russians, because they were nomadic and they had large territory, they developed a defense in depth. When you attacked, you couldn't get at them. They just keep retreating, and then they'd pick you off when you got overextended. That was the way they did. And Herodotus in the 5th century writes a lot about this because they were fascinated with their tactics. Well, if Napoleon had understood that, he wouldn't have lost his whole army. He went there, and the famous marshal in Russia retreats, even to the extent of retreating from Moscow and burning Moscow. Napoleon gets there, he can't believe what he's finding. There's no one to receive him. There's nobody there. All their food is gone, too. And that whole disaster is celebrated in Tchaikovsky's Overture of 1812. And he was in there with, I think the numbers are something like 700,000, and he left with 10,000. Because as the combination of the winter and the extended logistics, he lost more than four-fifths anyway of his army, by even the most conservative reckonings. And so that's interesting because for another reason, because Hitler is going to make the same mistake sometime later. So 1814, he's forced to abdicate. He's exiled in Elba, but he escapes the next year, declares himself emperor, lasts for a matter of months, defeats at Waterloo, and he's exiled at St. Helena and so forth. So now Napoleon maintained a lot of the principles of the French Revolution, including equality before the law, freedom of religion, those kinds of things. He had much to commend him. But he also created the French satellite kingdoms of Holland, Italy, Germany, and Spain, placed his brothers and other relatives on the on their respective thrones. So he has obviously his detractors and he has his zealots. He's a man that influenced history profoundly. But let's go ahead. Wars and rumors of wars. Let's go on to modern struggles for power. We have from 1912 to 1914, the national aspirations make the Balkans very volatile. Newly independent Serbia, Bulgaria, and Greece attack the Ottomans, the famous Ottoman Empire, in 1912, seeing the decline of the Turkish Ottoman Empire as an opportunity to extend their own territories. And Albania gains its independence that year, and so they go after the Ottomans. So we have, in 1914, to manage the rivalries and fearing and the nationalist unrest, the great powers of Europe formed rival alliances. Germany, Austria, Hungary, and Italy formed the Triple Alliance, and the Russia and the UK and France forming the Triple Entente. And the as Russia and Austria-Hungary intervene in the fighting that breaks out in the Balkans, the rest of Europe gets dragged into the First World War. We call it the Great War when we didn't know enough to number them. But when you get through the period of 1916 and 1925, one of the events that occurs that you need to be sensitive to is the Sykes-Picot Wartime Agreement. The Sykes-Picot was a secret wartime agreement between Britain and France, where they agreed to divide between them the lands of their enemy, the Ottoman Empire, once the World War ended. Now, the war isn't over yet, but they're already planning how to divide it up, and Britain has made all kinds of promises to the Arabs, and this is all secret. See, as an incentive during the war, the Arabs have been promised independent states in the areas formerly controlled by Turkey. And so what's the impact of this? Well, Faisal al-Hussein, under the leadership of General Allenby and the tactical supervision of a guy by the name of T.E. Lawrence, you all know Lawrence of Arabia, he assisted against the Turkish army during the war, and Faisal was awarded rule of the newly created state of Iraq under a British protective mandate. And this agreement, along with Britain's abrogation of its obligations to provide a Jewish homeland, lay the foundation for the continuing turmoil in the Middle East. Britain had a mandate from the League of Nations to provide a homeland for Israel. 75% of the land that was set aside for Israel was given to create the land called Transjordan. So the British Foreign Office laid the foundation for those griefs that were incurring still even today. But obviously after the war, things are breaking up. It's the Europe that emerges after the First World War is very radically different. The Austrian-Hungarian and the Ottoman empires have disappeared, and a host of smaller states have emerged. In Russia, you have the Russian Revolution that leads to the creation of the Soviet Union, a self-declared revolutionary socialist state. Okay, we get to the 1938 to 1940 period. Obviously, Adolf Hitler annexes his native Austria and the Sudetenland. Now, you need to understand, and we'll take the time here because we're going to run out of time, but you need to understand the strategy of Hitler in getting the Sudetenland. He creates the fiction that there's the German population within the Sudetenland is being abused by Sudetenland, and on that basis does a propaganda thing so that the whole world sees Czechoslovakia's attempt to hang on to its own property and its own citizens as if they are the barriers to peace. And they force, eventually, the yielding of the Sudetenland of Czechoslovakia to Hitler, which, of course, has all the factories, and it makes Czechoslovakia undefendable. Once he gets the Sudetenland, it's just a matter of months before he overruns Czechoslovakia. And so it's the rape of Czechoslovakia is something you need to understand, because the same thing is going on today, and it's unbelievable. But obviously, Hitler then overruns Czechoslovakia as it goes on. So now, later that month, he's going to invade Poland, and that starts World War II. Forces Britain and France, who had promised to protect Poland, to declare war on Germany, and World War II is on its way. And later that month, the Soviet Union invades Poland from the east, going west, and Poland then is partitioned between Germany and the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union attacks Finland in the winter of 39-40 and annexes the Baltic states in northern Romania. So we get to 41-43. We have Germany goes on to conquer Yugoslavia and Greece and launches the invasion of the USSR in 1941. By 42, Nazi Germany is at its peak of its power, with most of Europe under the control of Germany and its allies. So the Nazi boot is make its imprint on Europe. And in the USSR, Hitler's troops first make great progress, but they advancing to the gates of Moscow and Leningrad. But then guess what? Same thing happens. The invasion turns into a war of attrition in which the German army was gradually ground down by the reviving Soviet Union. And so that whole lesson, as it goes, it looks great for a while, but then, of course, dissolves as they experience the same thing that Napoleon did, in effect. By the end of World War II, Germany is dramatically reduced in size, and we have it's divided east and west, of course. Russia picks up the Eastern Bloc, as we call it. Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Ukraine occupies East Prussia, including Königsberg. And by 1949, much of Europe effectively becomes an extension of a massively expanded Soviet Empire. And the Soviet bloc also creates a buffer zone between the USSR and the rest of Europe. The Eastern Bloc becomes that buffer, but the buffer is going to boomerang on them in a sense here. And now it's in April of 1949 that NATO is formed for the express purpose of protecting Europe from the Russian movement here. 10 Western European states start this with the U.S. and Canada providing a military function here. Now, something else occurs. If you look down here where there's the British Mandate, down there at the eastern end of the Mediterranean, most of that mandate was given to create the state of Jordan, 75% of that commitment, so they already have been betraying Israel that early. But then finally the British wash the hands of it and walk in. We have the state of Israel formed in May 14th of 1948, and that, from a biblical point of view, is profoundly important. Many Bible scholars were taking great liberties with the text, but arguing that that could never happen. When it did happen, it should send everyone back to their Bibles to understand that God means what he says and says what he means. But Western Europe begins to consolidate politically and economically. The European Economic Community is created in 1957, precursor to the European Union. The first members are France, Germany, Italy, Belgium, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands. And then it later becomes it increases in power and size as Denmark, UK, and Ireland join in 73, Greece in 81, Spain and Portugal in 86. So we have the first group. We have France, Germany, Italy, and we have the Benelux countries, that are called, the first original six. They formed the Coal and Steel Community, and that was very successful. Became the model for the treaties of Rome to form the European Economic Community and the European Atomic Energy Community. Denmark, Britain, and Ireland join, growing it, and then Greece also joining it, and Spain and Portugal, so it's growing. After the war, of course, the winds of democratic revolution that sweeps across Eastern Europe, and communist rule begins to crumble country after country. Perhaps best exemplified by the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. That's probably the highlight of the breaking down. The Soviet Union collapses in 1991. The end of the Cold War is accompanied by the rising tide of nationalism that sees former republics and regions declaring their own independence. And so that many of those nations that were part of the Eastern Bloc are now, in some sense, independent. So we got Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Belarus, Ukraine. Many of these countries are countries that even the CIA didn't have files on because they were always considered part of the Soviet Union. They're independent countries now. So that's changing the whole landscape, Moldova and so forth. And we have the Yugoslavia breaks up into Croatia and and Bosnia and Albania and Macedonia and so forth. And so so we have the pieces. So World War II really just leaves you with a bunch of fragments. Now the empire begins to reemerge. Now, in 1951, a treaty was signed called the Treaty of Paris. You've probably never heard of it unless you're in international relations, but it turns out to be an incredibly ambitious and yet a very successful event. The visionaries recognized there are all kinds of attempts, I'm sparing you. There's half a dozen different treaties and stuff to try to create a peaceful environment after World War II. For you and I, it was ration stamps and things like that, but over there, they had tanks going through the yards. In other words, it was a different experience. Everybody felt they could never let that happen again. But all kinds of attempts to hit it directly just wouldn't work. There's too many animosities. A group of visionaries recognized the way you're going to get Europe at peace is to get to unite economically first, then politically. The way you unite economically is you start with the heavy industries. And so it took a very limited thing, coal and steel. But they created a multinational organization of six nations, France, Germany, Italy, and the three Benelux countries, signed the Treaty of Paris and created the European Coal and Steel Community. They basically administered the coal and steel community, prices and so forth. And it turned out to be very ambitious. It sounds easy, but it's very ambitious. It turned out to be very successful, so successful that it became a model of a treaty later. In 1957, in March, they signed the Treaty of Rome. You hear it. It's actually two treaties. There's one created the European Economic Community, the EEC, dubbed the Common Market by the press, and the European Atomic Energy Community. Both were effective January 1st of 1958. They also set for themselves some very ambitious objectives, but much to everyone's surprise, they made those objectives. Many of the cynics at the time said, these are a bunch of visionaries, nothing will have come of this, but turned out they couldn't have been further from the truth. France, let's take a look at the six original signatories. France, of course, population of about not quite 60 million, have a GDP of about 1.4 trillion euros. GDP per head is about 25,000, just to give you a frame of reference here. And so that's France. I think we understand France. I didn't add a lot there. Deutschland, Germany, population of about 82 million, over 2 trillion euros GDP, and slightly larger income than France, mean income. And then we have Belgium, one of the three Benelux countries, 10 million population. The GDP is modest, of course. Their revenue per person is up because it's mostly professionals. And then we have the Netherlands. And again, population about 16 million, GDP of about 400 billion euros. GDP here is about the same, in the same region here. And then we have Luxembourg. And population is only 400,000. GDP is about 23 billion euros, or putting it another way, they're probably the wealthiest per head in Europe. Average income is twice that of the average European. Luxembourg, mostly professionals, mostly lawyers, what have you. And Italy, of course, a population of about 58 million, GDP of about 1.4 trillion, GDP per head, a little slightly lighter, 24.5, compared to the others. So those are the original treaties, signers of the Treaty of Paris, the Treaty of Rome. In March in 58, they formed a European Parliament. For many, many years, I give talks and so forth, and people didn't even realize there was a European Parliament, separate from the parliaments of the individual countries. In 59, the Benelux group was formed, in effect. In 1967, an event occurred that many people don't understand. It was very simple. It was a merger of the EEC, the ECSE, and the EAEC. In other words, the Common Market, the Coal and Steel Community, and the Atomic Energy Community. They all had an executive branch. They just merged that executive branch called the Commission. So these three organizations combined to form what then was called the European Community. The press was slow to pick up on the significance here. They still kept calling it the Common Market, but that's a misnomer. But anyway, a few years later, a few more nations joined. UK, Ireland, and Denmark joined. And now there's not six, there's nine. And United Kingdom, population about 60 million, 1.4 trillion GDP, and about average European income. Ireland has about 4 million people, small GDP, but their GDP per head is interesting. It's higher than the others, other than Luxembourg. About 32,000. It's 30-40% higher than the others. And Denmark, population about 5 million. GDP is such to give a GDP per head of about 28.5, above average income in Denmark. And so we have then, in 1981, Greece joins. And that sent everybody to their Bibles. Because suddenly there are 10 members. And everybody, 10 toes or 10 heads. We all fell into that trap, I think, to some extent. Greece, by the way, is a population of about 11 million. GDP per head is 17.4, about half, almost a little better than half, say 60% of the average in the EU so far. And we'll look at more of that later. So that's the EU as it's forming up. There's 10 nations, and everybody thought, aha, maybe this is the revised Roman Empire. You need to recognize, we all fell in the same trap. It doesn't say that 10 nations come together. It says 10 emerge out of the combination. That's all yet future. We'll see. But in any case, in 1986, Spain and Portugal joined. Now they're 12. That blew the model of some of the experts in prophecy. And Spain had a population of about 40 million and about 20,000 per head per capita income to give you a feeling of the economy. And, of course, there's obviously Portugal also joins, population about 10 and 17.9 per head economics. I'll tie the economics together at the end, so you have to take notes on that. In 1986, the Single European Act was enforced. That's very, very important in terms of the unification, but we'll keep moving here. Germany, of course, unifies in 1990. That's a big deal. Berlin Wall comes down. You all know the story. Very, very exciting, but it sets a pattern. It shows it can be done. In 1993, we have the Maastricht Treaty that was signed, and I had the opportunity to interview 40 of the top leaders in 9 cities of the countries that were involved. And traveling with Ambassador Bill Middendorf, who was the ambassador to the EC in the Netherlands and the former Secretary of the Navy, a neat guy. He took me through, and we got a chance to go behind the scenes to see the maneuvering that was going on by the International Socialists. In each country, it was a very different strategy, but in each country, they manipulated until they finally got it approved. The Maastricht Treaty replaces the Treaty of Rome, much more powerful, much more centroid, if you will. Following that, a couple of years, Austria, Sweden, and Finland join. And Austria is got a population of 8 million, but a GDP per head of about 27, substantially higher than the rest of Europe, and the average, that is. And then we have Sweden with almost 9 million, and again, average GDP per head. And of course, Finland, which is about 5 million population, but about average income relative to the European standard. So then by this time, it becomes obvious to many, but not, they actually formalize the criteria. What does it take for a country to join? See, there's a population of 48 different countries that make up what could be Europe. And so we've got, 15 here so far. So in June 1993, the European Council sets up the criteria for acceptability of candidates. The stability of institutions is one of the key criteria here that will guarantee democracy, rule of law, human rights, and respect for and protection of minorities. Minorities are a big thing, especially the gypsies. The Roma is the formal name of them. So it's interesting to understand, also a functioning market economy as well as the capacity to cope with the competitive pressure and market forces by being a member of the union. Suddenly they're going to be in this cauldron. And they have a third thing, adherence to the aims of the political. Obviously they want people to concur with their political, economic, and the monetary aims. What's interesting is while the Copenhagen criteria sets up a barrier of what it takes to join, the European Union is helping them get over that barrier. In other words, they're working with each of these countries to help them get qualified for that criteria. And that's often not really understood. And so since the Berlin Wall fall, they've been spending a great deal of time. They spent $85 billion into help the countries of Central and Eastern Europe, which is about, by the way, that's about, in real terms, it's about the same as the Marshall Plan in the aftermath of World War II. It's about that size of commitment. And it wasn't just to put the economies back on track. It was to help them build democratic institutions, to encourage the development of a civil society, to train administrations, and to build the judicial systems, all that infrastructure. Now, the current candidates are as follows. We have, in the year 2004, Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, Slovakia, and Slovenia are joining from the Central European states, but also the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, are joining, and 2 islands in the Mediterranean, Cyprus and Malta. So you've got 10 people that are joining in 2004, but that's not all. We've got some others coming. There's something else that happened before we close this session. In the year 2002, the euro is established as a common currency. We're going to talk about that in the next session with some surprises. I think what you'll learn there will be surprising. The question that should be in front of us now is, Quo vadis? Where goest thou? Where are you going, guys? And we'll talk about that in session 2.